Head up to the BOAG World Show, the longest running web design podcast where we look at user experience design, conversion rate optimization and working in the web. On this month's show, we're going to be discussing AI-powered user research repositories, and then in the very next breath, a warning about the dangers of AI. So make of that what you will. My name is Paul BOAG, and joining me, as always, is Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. You're right, mate. How's it going?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. It was really interesting. We were having a moan in the Agency Academy Slack channel. I don't know whether you noticed that.
I didn't know. No, I've been too busy, Paul.
Oh, well, you've actually been doing work. We're all feeling a bit burnt out, and we're blaming AI for it. So yes, that's where we're currently at. It's because
that's the thing that is already a recognised thing.
Yeah, and it really is as well. It used to be you sat down and you did one thing, right? Mm. But now I've got like three or four agents on the go, all doing different things, and you're having to hold it all in your head. Of, you know, and you have to check and review and all of the rest of it. And so, yeah, I'm a shit ton more productive, but I'm knackered. And I'm not the only one. Several people were moaning about it. So it's a thing, is it? Have you read about it somewhere then?
Yeah, even though I have for the first time in a very long time come up with some reads for this week, which are a little bit AI. Well, they are quite AI related. Yeah, I'll see if I can dig one out for the next show because it's basically, I think it's called AI burnout, which is to do with I'm going to repeat pretty much what you just said, but having to manage too many things.
Yeah.
So you basically become a manager. Rather than a doer. That's a bit too strong, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
I'd probably be quite good at this because I've always just had a million things on and I'll just skip between them. But I'm not a big user of AI. I use it a bit, but when there's a specific task where it's going to help. I don't help it run my day, whereas I probably could cope with it. But I can completely understand that we're not... I think I saw a quote that, you know, we're only meant to sort of deal with, you know, whether we're hungry or, or whether it's wet and we need to get under some, you know, some shelter and having to deal with, you know, very complex issues, multiple ones, and make sure that you're on top of it is going to make you go bleh time.
I reckon I can only be productive at that level for about 4 hours a day, and after that I begin to kind of start dropping things and fucking up.
Glitch.
What about you? How are you? Are things going all right with you?
They are okay. Headscape, we won a new client the other day.
Yay.
About and I mean time. Bearing in mind how long I've been saying we haven't done that, I mean that's I think we should have a little party. not a particularly big thing, but for another American university, so that's nice.
Oh, good.
And we're also courting another...
courting.
In the old sense of the word.
Yeah.
Another American university, which we would love to work with. So, yeah, I guess our marketing work that we've been doing may be starting to pay off, or it could be complete chance. Who knows?
You don't know. That's the annoying thing about it. You know, you ask, how did you find us? And inevitably the answer is, oh, I don't quite know. I can't remember, you know.
Every time. Oh, I think I just looked it up on Google. Really? No, you didn't. At least I know where both of these came from. One of them was, we do a lot of work for the University of Michigan. And this guy runs a journal for another university, which I'm not going to mention yet because I don't want to jinx it. And he was looking to sort of, how can we improve our website? Found the one we did, thought, that's what I want.
Right.
Got in contact with the people at Michigan that run it. And they said, oh, Headscape did it. Go talk to them. So that was,
perfect.
Yeah, so that's got nothing to do with our marketing.
No.
I realise.
No.
the other one has because she came... I basically decided that because we've done work for law schools, that I should be talking to other law schools, and like, you know, cold email basically, but with a good story.
Yeah,
And a couple of people came back, and she was one of them. But well, of course, she knows.
That's good.
You know. So, yeah. Anyway, also, Paul, I was down your neck of the woods the other day.
Yes, you were. Showing off your breakfasts to me.
Well, yes, exactly, Paul. All I'm going to say is you must go there for okay. breakfast. It was, you know, that you and I, in our sort of aging state, mustn't eat that sort of thing very often. But every now and then, you're
hang
around,
on a minute. I'm a lot younger than you. I want to remind you. Don't tar me with your
crush. With my great age.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know. But you've had as I think probably discussed, maybe not on this podcast, but on other podcasts, you've had your issues with what with your eating, haven't you? So I was just looking after you, Paul.
That's very kind of you. Thank you very
Anytime.
Much. Anytime. So anyway, should we talk about topic for today? So I was quite surprised that I haven't already talked about this topic, and I had to triple check to make sure I haven't, because it's something I'm really enthusiastic about. I think I vaguely mentioned the idea of AI-generated personas before. We have talked about that, I think.
More than once, Paul, yes.
Yeah, but it's kind of a little bit broader than that that I want to talk about today. I want to talk about user research and user research repositories, right? Because there are an increasing number of the clients that I work with do user research. They've got their own in-house UX teams, and they might even have specialist UX researchers, although in a lot of cases they've just got kind of generalist UX people, if that makes sense. And so the typical pattern from what I see in most organizations is that these people go away and do research, normally for a particular project. They then give a PowerPoint presentation to stakeholders who either nod along and then completely ignore everything that was just said, or nod along and agree. But in either case, that's then that research done and dusted, right? And
yep.
That's great, maybe in the short term, if they nod along and agree and you go and do something about it. But it does mean that that knowledge just evaporates and you don't get any long-term value out of that. So the solution to that has traditionally been to create some kind of research repository. But the problem is, who actually is using these things, right? We create these repositories of information about all the different testing that we've done. But oftentimes that feels quite cumbersome to do, because if you're not on top of it, say, for example, you decided to create a user research repository today, you might have done years worth of user research that's in PowerPoint presentations and, you know, kind of user interview transcripts and surveys, and all of this stuff is all over the place. And bringing it together and putting it into a repository feels like quite a big job. And
yes.
Even if you do that, you're then left with a load of documents that have become a dumping ground that are quite hard to kind of navigate and find anything of value if you're working on a specific project. And yeah, there are tools where you can search on them and that kind of stuff, but that's pretty hard as well. And so most of the time, if anybody is using these repositories at all, it's just other UX professionals, right? The very people who kind of understand the research anyway. And so what's the benefit kind of thing? And everybody else is just ignoring them. And so this can all feel like a massive wasted opportunity. So what I'm kind of interested in is how AI has changed the game around all of that. I know all we talk about is AI, but
I'm going to talk about something different on this subject, by the way.
Oh, are you?
Yes.
Now?
Old-fashioned.
Okay, what were you going to talk about? I want to know.
Well, there is another way of doing this, of ensuring that things stay front of mind.
Yeah.
Outside of people in UX and for writers, designers, whatever, is print them out big and stick them on the walls, which is
yes.
a really, really good thing to do.
It is. It is a really good thing to do. Absolutely, I agree with that.
And because I wrote an article basically saying that a couple of months back. the conclusion of which is, you know, because if you, I can remember we looked at some good examples of personas that, you know, got for high fidelity, well-designed personas that for, I think it was MailChimp, maybe?
Yes,
anyway,
they're the ones,
back in the day.
Yeah.
And they were really good. But what we've, and we've done that for many clients over the years, but what we've ended up getting, the ones that you stick on the wall are less and less and less and less detailed to the point of actually all you need is the face. Maybe that's a little bit too
and
strong.
And the name.
It's a reminder that mm-hmm. they exist. And then because unless you don't interact with these things very often, you know what each of these characters are, talking about personas, and you probably know about the user journey maps and all that kind of thing as well. So all you need is the face. I then went on to this last month to say, but what about should we be having faces on personas? But I'll save that thought for another day.
Yeah.
But I see what I like about what I think you're going to say, Paul, is it'll happen automatically with what you're going to say.
Well,
whereas,
not quite. I think there's a slight difference between what you're talking about and what I'm talking about, because you're talking about personas, right? And I agree that there is a big advantage of having personas on the wall to remind people. Totally agree with that. However, mm-hmm. a user research repository is a repository of all the user research you've ever done in its raw form, right?
Not just personas,
yeah. So and that is, you might argue, well, not everybody needs to know or have access to that information anyway. But the problem comes in that you often then end up repeating research in slightly different forms, or research doesn't get done at all. When actually, if you created a repository of research, then people could just go to that to find out, you know, what had been done before. But it's kind of overwhelming, and that's where AI begins to change the game. Right. First of all, AI is really good for creating a user research repository, because you can just throw everything at it. You know, every PDF, every old persona, every survey, every bit of data that you've got, anything you can lay your hands on, you can just pump it into AI, and it will structure and organize that information into a repository for you. Right. Which mm-hmm. is incredibly powerful. So where it used to be this huge, painful task to create a user research repository, now it's pretty easy to do in comparison. But the best bit is you can then make that content accessible to absolutely everyone, not just a UX specialist. Because traditional search on these kinds of repositories require you to know specifically what you're looking for, while AI lets you have a conversation with that repository. So once you've got it in place, you can then put a chat interface on it and say, well, I'm working on this feature and this product, you know, and I'm doing this kind of thing, or I'm trying to appeal to this audience or whatever it be. What research have we already done on that that might be relevant or might be useful? So you can be much vaguer than you can be with a traditional search.
Yeah.
So a product manager could ask something like, you know, what do users think about our checkout process, and get this kind of synthesized answer that might come across, you know, come from like five different research studies that they never even knew existed. And that it means a lot of new research requests can also get answered. Let me explain what I mean by that. So let's imagine somebody goes along and types in, you know, well, what I just said. What do users think about our checkout process? If you set up the AI in the repository correctly, it will be intelligent to know and go, do you know what? We've got no research on checkouts at the moment, but here's some best practice for the product manager. But at the same time, I'm going to make a note of the fact that we've got no research on that and send that to the user research and UX team so that they can now go away and do some user research in that area to fill in the gaps in the repository. So it's a great way A, of creating the initial repository, B, enabling people to access it better, but C, identify gaps that need to then be filled, you know, with more, you know, more research.
Can you rely on AI to reliably do that, though? Really?
Yes, you can. Yeah. At least
someone
in my...
asked it a question along that using your example. I want some. My experience of AI is if you ask it something it doesn't know, it makes it up.
That's because it hasn't been trained properly, right?
Okay. You did say if it's been set up properly.
Yeah. So what you would do, you do two levels to it, right? Well, you could even argue three. First of all, you've got your basic instructions that say very explicitly, do not make shit up, right? you know, or whatever other requirements that you need from it, of how you want it to respond. Yeah. Then as part of those instructions, you say, before you return the answer to the user, go through this quality gate check, right?
Okay.
So, you know, does it meet these requirements? And then finally, you could get it to even go, now I want you to check back against the original sources that you mentioned to make sure they're all existing and accurate. So if you add in these kind of layers of checks and balances in to make sure that what you get back is reliable.
Okay.
But even if, let's be super pessimistic and say 1 in 10 things that it answers is incorrect, right? That's still better than having nothing at all. And even that incorrect, if it gives you an incorrect answer, it's still going to give you generic best practice. It's not going to suddenly say, oh, everybody thinks your checkout process is wonderful, right? Worst case scenario is it'll go, I can't find any specific research on this. So what I'm going to do is make up some general best practice when it comes to checkout, right? So yeah.
In this scenario, I agree entirely.
It depends on what you're using it for. For example, medical advice, I would have a much stricter, you know, criteria on its answers, you know? So it depends
on
what you're
using it for.
Should
I give my money away?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. Use some bloody common sense. And you can also caveat these things. And, you know, if you use Claude, for example, every time I start Claude, it's got a little line under it that says something like, Claude makes shit up sometimes, double check everything. And, you know, people, yes, are inherently lazy and don't do that. Mm. But it's still, in this case, that it's the consequences of it making stuff up is not the end of the world.
It's a walled garden, which makes fine.
The reason I like this is that A, it gets, you know, it creates an easy interface for people to start asking questions about the user, a bit like those virtual personas. B, it has huge cost saving benefits because before you're commissioning any new research, you can check what you already know. So those two things are really good. Now, I don't think that A, this replaces your big posters on the wall. But I would maybe, so then what you could do is you compare this repository with those digital persona, virtual personas I talked about before. So in case you didn't listen to that, that basically what you do is you take the content of your repository, you get AI to analyze it, and then create a set of personas based on the data that's in your user research repository. So now you've got a set of personas that, and you can create a chat interface on that set of personas so that people can then talk to those personas and get answers for them. Now, does that replace your pictures on the wall? Absolutely not. So what you do, because that still means people have to think, yes, I need to use that amazing AI tool, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what you do is on those posters, you put a QR code. So you snap the QR code and now you're talking to that user that's on the poster or a virtual facsimile of them, right? So I think that's bloody amazing as a way of getting the user's voice into an organization, organizing the research that's been done, identifying gaps in it. And I just don't understand why more organizations, well, I do understand why more organizations aren't doing it, is because their UX teams are too small and too busy to do this shit. So hire me to do it. There you go. See? Oh, that was good, wasn't it? That was subtle. Yeah. So, that was basically all I wanted to say on that particular subject. App of the week or app of the month or whatever it is. So I thought
I'd pick... this is app of your life, Paul. This
app
one,
of my
not?
Life. Yes, it is. But I did pick this one kind of on purpose because it relates to the conversation that we've just had. So the app of the month, that I must have done this as a recommendation before because I'm obsessed with it, is a tool called Notion. You've probably heard of Notion because they're quite a big tool. And yeah, Marcus is right. I'm utterly obsessed with Notion. I run my entire business on it. If Notion goes down, I go down. I cease to exist. Right. So, but I wanted to talk about it specifically today because I am pretty convinced it is the best platform out there for doing these user research repositories. There are supposed specialist platforms that do it. But actually, I don't think they're as good as using something like Notion. What Notion gives you, it gives you two things. One is it gives you utter flexibility in the sense that you can structure your user research repository however you need to specifically for your organization. And it can also take in pretty much any form of user research that you might have done. So whether it be a survey, whether it be data and analytics, whether it be a diary study or a user interview or whatever it is, or user testing, whatever it is, you can bring it into Notion pretty simply and pretty easily in order to create this repository. And then second, Notion has got a really powerful AI agent built into it that can run through this repository and access everything in it and search on it and that kind of stuff. So I think it's a really good tool. But that said, I'm talking to the RNLI. Yeah, that's right. Is it B?
Lifeboats
people. What is it?
Yeah, RNLI.
Yeah, for some reason I wanted to put
Royal
a B.
National Lifeboat Institute, I believe.
Yeah. They're not a client, but I've just got chatting with them. And we've been talking about user research repositories. And in their organization, they use Copilot. And they've got, so they can do the same thing in something like SharePoint, for example, where they have all of their repository information in SharePoint and then Copilot just looks at SharePoint and pulls out what it needs to. So you can do it in a lot of different systems, but Notion, I think, is the one. Perhaps I'm biased. Well, I am biased because it's the one I really know. But it's a good one. It's definitely worth checking out for organising any kind of information like this. So I thought I'd give it a mention.
I can't help but want to ask you the question, so I'm going to ask it, Paul. Yeah. What if Notion did go down? Have you got backups in different places?
What if you lose internet access?
Well, yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah, I'll just write letters to people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are...
Yeah, fair point. Yeah. Sometimes
you know, there are things in our businesses that are single points of failure. It's a conversation that we've had. And I would feel differently if Notion was... It's like every time Amazon Web Services go down, half the internet stops working suddenly, doesn't it?
Cloudflare has been one of recently.
Cloudflare's another.
Twice.
Yeah. So we do have those kinds of dependencies.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So that's my kind of attitude. Notion is big enough, right, that I'm confident in them. They're profitable, right, which I consider another big factor in their favour. But, I mean, we could end up in a world where we don't want to be using American apps, for example.
Yeah. Some people I know, some people you know, have dumped all of their American affiliations or subscriptions, whatever you want to call them.
Well, we're also finding an increasing problem with organizations. I've got several larger organizations I work with that can't use American software because of GDPR and that kind of side of things, because they're just not compliant.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to hold any kind of private data in them, which I have to say, on a user research repository, you absolutely shouldn't be doing, right? It should all be anonymized, and you don't want to hold people's personal information on that. So it's not relevant in that particular case. But, you know, in Notion, I've got contact information and, you know, confidential information held in that. And it's like, should I be?
Possibly not. Although we're having an ongoing nightmare due to consent management at the moment. A lot of our clients were using Cookie Pro, which is bought by OneTrust, I think. And the Cookie Pro product is being discontinued, or it's being changed to be 10 times more expensive. As you can tell, I'm not really part of this particular conversation. So we've been looking at alternatives, and you think you find, yeah, that's the one. Then you go, no, it's not. It's not accessible. and all of this kind of, you just keep going down this route, and then you kind of come back to the conclusion that actually maybe the expensive one is the one you want.
Yeah.
And it's just like everything else these days, that everything's just getting more and more expensive.
The other... It is interesting, because the cookie notification thing drives me nuts. I mean, I've talked about this before, but it's a absolute waste of time. Worst piece of EU legislation ever. Really good intentions, you know, I understand, but all of the ad people that they were trying to target have moved to browser sniffing anyway, so it's not like helping at all with the problem that they were trying to solve, and just making an enormous pain in the ass for everybody else's sites. And then the other one of that, which I feel a little bit differently about, and it's more nuanced, is the new legislation around unsuitable images. You know, so if you're going to use Pornhub, you now have to prove that you're an adult, etc. Obviously, I kind of fully accept that. I think that's very sensible. But the big problem that it's created is that a lot of companies that host imagery, right?
Yeah.
In America, have gone, screw it, we're not going to support that anymore. You know, but we're not going to comply with that. And so things like huge numbers of images now, just you cannot see this image in your region, because it exists on websites absolutely everywhere across the internet, but are being pulled from America, who don't want to be liable for this. And so it's just broken big chunks of the web, because they'd not thought through the consequences. It's really hard to get this kind of legislation right. I was speaking to somebody from Ofcom about AI boyfriend-girlfriend things, you know, these fake boyfriend-girlfriend. And they're thinking about how to legislate around that, and they wanted to pick my brain over it. And it's like, it's really hard to get right without having unintended consequences.
The one with the imagery, it's kind of like, well, the idea behind the internet was that it shouldn't be kind of, I can't find the right word, but, you know, closed down in any way. It's meant to be just this free platform. But equally, of course, as soon as you do that, then you end up with what we've got in the world now.
Yeah.
So, which ain't great. So doing something, I think, in this particular example, is better than nothing. And if it's broken a lot of other things around,
I do. I feel, in that case, I agree with you. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, all it means is that you know, websites that want to operate in the EU are going to have to find an EU-based image provider, right?
Yeah.
And yes, that is a big inconvenience. But when you're talking about, you know, the safety of children, I think that's a very, you know, a price yes. worth paying. Yeah. I don't feel like that with the cookie legislation, because instantly it became meaningless, because, you know, the companies that were the offenders, the ones that the EU wanted to target, just switched technology. That's all yeah. they did, you know. So anyway, let's talk about your yes. interesting reads, because you had some good ones. I the first one in particular, I had no clue about.
Me neither. This Dan at Headscape found this one, which I sort of was like, really? Anyway, so it's I thought to start off, I've got a couple of interesting reads, a couple of articles this week. Well, I thought I would take a different look at AI, because obviously Paul's such a massive fanboy. and maybe we should be a bit careful, or maybe that's not really what it is, but it's just looking at it from a slightly different angle.
Yeah.
And I'm picking on Google as well, particularly. I don't know why, but it just happens to be the case. So the first one is a Tech Juice article entitled "Google is quietly rewriting headlines with AI in search results," which is like, is it? And then I started reading the article. Apparently, it's been doing this for years anyway.
Really?
Yes. I'm not quite sure how it's been doing it. Maybe even manually, but I don't know. It has been rewriting the titles of certain content in its articles. But with the advent of AI, with Gemini, I assume in this case, it's gone into overdrive. And it said, I think it said that, four months ago, we're trialing this, and then a month after that, it's in use and it's happening every day. Anyway, to use an example of the kind of thing that it's changing, the one that's come from this article, it had an article that was originally titled, "I used the cheat on everything AI tool and it didn't help me cheat on anything." That was shortened to "cheat on everything AI tool," which obviously completely changes its meaning. You go from "this is rubbish" to "here's get your cheat on everything and AI tool."
That's the fundamental problem with AI. Well, it's not the problem with AI. It's the problem with how people are using AI. Is you have to have a human in the loop. If you take a human out of the loop, if you have no human judgment in it, you're going to get shit like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I mean, I'm still left a little bit not knowing where this is all coming from, because unless you've got your conspiracy theory hat on, and I'm not a conspiracist at all, but I'm thinking, well, with that particular example, you could say, well, AI is being pro AI, but then I keep coming back to why? What's the point? Even like so, before AI, why was Google changing the
titles to encourage more? Well, no, because they don't really care about traffic that much. They don't care whether you click through. In fact, they prefer you not to.
All I can assume is that it's meant to sort of help better summarize. So. We are helping you understand what the content is behind this title, because it's but all you're getting is the title of the link, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
There are other articles. There are other examples in this article where the title's been changed to use words and subject matter that don't exist in the article at all. So
that's
again,
weird.
Yeah, it is really weird. But you know, what I keep coming back to is what's wrong with just keeping the original headline.
Why it wouldn't will be something that? It will be something about driving traffic, wouldn't it? It's got to be of driving click-throughs or improving engagement or some. There's some logic there, but I mean, yeah, I would agree. It's a solution looking for a problem. There's a lot of that with AI at the moment of people using it to solve something that's not really fundamentally a problem.
No, so that was a real eye-opener for me. You can't trust Google to recreate your headlines that you spent minutes over.
I don't care anyway. I don't use Google, so don't give a shit. Well, I use Google. Yeah, I don't use Google search, I should add. It's not that I'm against using anything Google. But yes, you're right. The vast majority of people still do.
So, Google bashing part two.
Yes. Now, this one, I've got more opinions on. This one I do care a little bit more about. You are right, Mike. Such a clickbaity title. You noted that, I noticed.
Yes, this is the title. Testing suggests Google's AI overviews tell millions of lies per hour.
Yeah.
Which I did like. That made me smile a bit. But this is an ARS Technica article. Mm-hmm. And there appears to be something in it. And I wrote the words in my notes. We all use the AI summary overviews that Google presents us with. And then I thought, well, I do. So I guess everyone does. A lot of people use the AI summaries. And I guess what I mean by that is, and this is purely anecdotal on my behalf, quite a lot of the time I'll be looking up something, I don't know, like the golf club that I went to over the weekend down near you. I'd look that up, and if it told me what the address was, I'd believe it. I wouldn't go through to the website and check it. But anyway, so this article talks about some analysis that was done by the New York Times that suggests that AI overviews are incorrect 10% of the time, which is interesting. You used that figure earlier to, in this podcast, Paul. They used an example in the article where, when asked for the date on which Bob Marley's former home became a museum, AI overview cited three pages, two of which didn't discuss the date at all. The final one, Wikipedia, listed two contradictory years, and AI overviews confidently, and that's a really important word, confidently chose the wrong one. And there are many, many other examples of this. Google, of course, said, well, you know, your research is flawed, blah-de-blah-de-blah, which it is. But it then went on to sort of summarise, saying, well, yes, of course, we can't get it right all the time. Or AI can't get it right all the time. So that goes back to what I was just saying. My beef with all of this is, if I'm the average user, people aren't checking. They aren't going through and checking responses. They're not checking that the address for the golf club is... They don't go through the website anymore. So being wrong 1% of the time, if we're talking about the entirety of the internet, is potentially a problem.
Yes and no is my response to that. First of all, I think this isn't a Google-specific problem. I think this is a problem with large language models, that they are predictive and they don't always predict accurately. And so, yeah, they will get things wrong. They're also reliant on the data that was, you know, that is provided to them, of which, you know, you talked about the Wikipedia one had two contradictory dates. And so I don't think it's fair to pick on Google, other than the fact that I guess they've got a bigger responsibility to be accurate just simply because of the scale of usage. But here's where I'm less sympathetic, is that we do have a responsibility, and we fully accept that we tend to trust humans. We tend to trust what's written on the internet. We shouldn't do that either, right? No. Why is AI any different? Oh, shocking. Something on the internet's not true. You know, it's like, and so the truth is, you know, why should I trust this article? I bet there's things in this article that's incorrect. I bet there's things that you tell me that are incorrect.
No.
We live in a world where things are inaccurate. So it comes down to an individual responsibility it's a risk-benefit analysis, basically, that we have to make every single day with every piece of information that we're fed, which is comparing the effort with validating whether that thing is true or not against the risk of getting it wrong, right? So, for example, let's take your address, you know, that you wouldn't go through and check that that address is real. I would personally check, because me getting lost is a bigger pain in the ass than clicking through and checking. I'm not saying you were wrong doing it. I think we're all different, right? You know, it's a bigger pain in the ass than just clicking through on that website and double checking that piece of data. So I don't think it's, everybody makes out it's Google's problem or AI's problem. I just think it's a, we accept it in every other aspect of life that things will be inaccurate. Why do we suddenly hold AI to a higher standard? Other than, and you nailed it earlier, the word confidently.
Hmm.
Right? That I think it's AI
bang,
says
bang,
things.
Bang, 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 bang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All it needs to add is something like, it looks like the address of your place is da 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 da, rather than the address is da 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 da. And this is where you get into a user experience thing and conversational interfaces.
have a prominent link rather than, you know.
Right.
So, but I think we're going to have to maybe agree to disagree a little bit on this one, because even though I think you're right in the only way that this is going to get fixed is if people change their behavior. But what is annoying is that you've got an extra step here added because of this, potentially an extra step, where in the past you used to type in East Dorset Golf Club or whatever it was. It's changed its name. It's posher now. It's the Country Club. And the top link would be East Dorset, which I'd click on. There would be no reading the AI summary. I'd just click on it and go there and find what I was looking for. But now I read the AI summary that confidently tells me something that I go, yeah, that's right, and walk off. But you're right, I need to now go, okay, I need to go and check that on the website. So I've added an unnecessary step has been added, which is just annoying.
Yeah. I get that. No, I fully accept that. I think we do agree over that. I've literally just gone. I mean, perhaps I've turned the AI off on something. I never use Google, but I don't get an AI summary. I didn't ask a specific question.
It varies. Sometimes it appears, sometimes it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't.
Yes.
Address. Maybe address. Oh, right.
Yeah, address. When I added address to the end, it did. And then but immediately below that is a link to click through.
People click on those links? No, they don't. What I'm saying.
And I would agree with that. So what you're saying is there's an added level of cognitive effort.
Yes.
Of having to ask yourself, do I trust this summary?
Based on what you're saying about most of what's on the internet is a load of old tripe anyway, then nearly every time it should be, well, I better add. So what was the point?
Well, no, I almost take the opposite approach. No, see, I see it the other way. I see it as, well, it's just as likely the bloody website hasn't been updated and is wrong. Right?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you can't completely trust that. But the organisation's website is got to be the place to find their address.
It's got to be the definitive
secondary
source.
Place.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. No, I accept that. So what's the answer then? Is it to get rid of those entirely?
Yes, but they're not going to. People like them because they confidently tell them stuff quickly. But if 10% of it is wrong, then that's a problem. I don't know what the answer is, Paul. I'm not here to give you answers.
that's part of it. I'm trying it on DuckDuckGo now. See, now DuckDuckGo is giving me a search answer as well. So it's giving me an AI answer. See, I like it.
I just said that. I think they're great and I believe them. And it's like, this is handy. Don't have to faff about going to websites anymore. It just tells me this stuff. And then this article tells me that only 1 in 10 are right. Oh,
no.
Shit.
Nine out of 10.
Well,
right.
one out of 10. Sorry, you know what I meant. One out of 10 is wrong. Anyway.
But you see, even that, I'm not convinced of that number. It depends on what you're asking.
Wishful thinking, Paul.
No, that's based on the benchmarks associated with a large language model. You see, in that particular example of Bob Marley, it wasn't the AI's fault. It correctly quoted Wikipedia. Wikipedia was wrong.
Oh, it had two or three dates, and it confidently picked the wrong one.
Yeah, but what does that mean? I mean, to say it confidently picked it, I mean, what is the wording? Let's have a look at what the wording actually is. That's the key, is the wording. Yes, it is confident. The Dorset Golf and Country Club is located in Hyde near postcode is.
And it's probably right.
Well, I suspect it is.
Yeah.
It's in, yeah.
I just down the road from Newport. Like, lovely part of the world. Gorgeous.
Everybody just moans and whinges about any new technology that comes along. And so, you know, I haven't got a problem with it.
Good for you.
It's an education thing. People just need to realise that AI gets it wrong sometimes. It's like going, why doesn't Notion make my breakfast for me? Well,
don't think that's quite what we're saying here, Paul.
That isn't fair. I know.
Although, wouldn't it be good if AI did do that? Why doesn't AI paint my living room for me?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be bloody fantastic?
To be serious, Mike, the serious point there is that AI is claiming to make my breakfast and paint your living room, but is not doing either. That's the fundamental issue, isn't it? It's the claiming with confidence. Have they got any kind of disclaimer? All AI responses may include mistakes written in tiny text.
Little tiny text.
So I guess they're covering. Although that doesn't appear, interestingly, that disclaimer doesn't appear until you hit the show more button.
Yeah, and quite a lot of the time you get what you want, or you get what you think you want, right at the top.
Yeah, which is where the message needs to be. So, you know, it's
and
got...
Links. You don't
it does have
get,
a link.
The links are in the top. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but it could at least say... See, this. Is, so basically what we're saying is this is a user interface problem. It's
well,
how...
kind of. I think it should just be dumped. And just go back to clicking through to the what's more likely to be the definitive source. What's wrong with that? Nothing.
Yeah, but they're not doing that.
No, they're not going to, but...
No. But, all right, within the constraints of the business model that they're operating under, which is that they want you to stay on the website so they can show ads, right? Mm-hmm. We can wish all they want to... Oh, let's strip out... I wish that they'd get rid of all of the ads. I wish they'd go back to the clean interface they used to have when they were making no fucking money. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a ridiculous argument.
But so many things have been ruined by this. I use the Monzo banking app, which is still pretty good.
Okay. Why don't you pay for search then?
But I'm not paying for search, Paul. Don't be ridiculous.
There you go. See, that's the problem. So therefore, you
someone
are
else
the product.
Should. Someone else.
It should be subsidised. It should be like the NHS, right?
Yes.
We're just taxed on it.
Well, to be honest, I mean that's not a bad idea. Everyone uses it all the time, so why shouldn't we just be taxed? And then
it's not
be
the
clean,
American way.
Clean.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's certainly not the American way. No, God, no.
But, yes, it's quite an interesting
when,
idea.
When Obama comes in, do you want free healthcare? Oh, my God, no. And we're all like, what? Why wouldn't you want that? Anyway, still don't
perhaps
know.
We need BBC search. That's what we need.
Yeah.
Funded by a licence payer fee. BBC, make it happen. There we go. Yeah.
Done.
Marcus. We went off on a complete tangent then, didn't we? Which is a good job because the show was running short time-wise. So
it's
now
not
it's
now,
back
though.
On track.
Yes,
Marcus,
I've got to,
what's your joke?
I have a joke. Paul Edwards shared this one and it made me giggle. So I'm entering the annual Give Helium to a Sheep contest again and I'm a bit nervous. Last year, the bar was very high.
I knew it'd be something to do with bar, and I was trying to think what would a higher pitched bar be. But yeah, no, that was better. That was a good one. All right, I approve. Marvelous. They're getting better recently, Marcus. I think you're dialing in on the things that amuse me. That's what it is. All right, that's great. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. I'll be interested if you, any of you, do listen to this. You hit us up on X or LinkedIn or whatever to see what you think about some of these subjects, because I'd be interested in what other people think. It's an interesting one. All right, thank you very much, Marcus. Thank you for listening, everybody, and we will talk to you again next month. Goodbye.
Bye.